Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 655, The Obama File, Part 2, Badjacketing Obama. This program is being recorded on November 29th of the year 2008. In this broadcast, we are going to take both a look back and a look ahead, and specifically, we're going to be taking a look at not only some of Barack Obama's early associates in the Chicago area, but we're also going to take a look at tactics that were used to try to smear Barack Obama during the campaign. The reason that I'm going into this is that I think a look at these forces, not only a look at some of the vulnerable places of attack upon a Barack Obama presidency, but also taking a look at tactics, strategies that might be used to try to tar Barack Obama with the twin brushes of, quote, terrorism and, quote, Islamism, unquote. I should perhaps begin by defining the term badjacketing. It's an intelligence community term which refers to setting something up for a fall. You can badjacket an individual by associating people into their or secreting people into their milieu, there's my favorite word again, in order to discredit them through association, through guilt by association. You can badjacket an individual too by getting them to espouse stupid or ridiculous things or things that are going to discredit them in the eyes of a particular group. You can badjacket a path of inquiry. It's very common for elements to intelligence elements to badjacket a path of inquiry by releasing something like 80 or 90% of the relevant information, but then secreting into that maybe anywhere from 10 to 30% disinformation, so that when journalistic sources begin to run with the story and are able to verify it, then all of a sudden they come across some disinformation in the middle of it, and that causes the story to be discredited. Journalists are a little bit like flocks of birds. When one lands, they all land, and when one flies away, they all fly away, and the intelligence community is very aware of this. So, badjacketing is basically setting something or somebody up for a fall by introducing elements into either their milieu or into the midst of an inquiry which will subsequently discredit or destroy the credibility of the individual or the inquiry. I think that it is mandatory that we take a look at what the attacks that were directed against Barack Obama and also some of his associations. I also want to, because I think that the future is very perilous indeed, and indeed something I'm going to be talking about in weeks to come. No sooner did Barack Obama get elected, then we have Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two from al-Qaeda, an offshoot of the fascist Muslim Brotherhood, coming out and attacking Barack Obama as a, quote, house Negro, unquote. And then, sure enough, the Islamic Terror Front was relatively quiet outside of Iraq. And no sooner does Barack Obama get elected, and with a very, very shaky American economy, there is a threat of terrorism against the New York City subway system, New York being America's financial center, and a very real devastating attack dominating the holiday headlines in Mumbai, India. Mumbai is the Indian financial center as well. If, in fact, an attack were to be successfully perpetrated on New York, something along the lines of September 11th or worse, it could very easily collapse what's left of the American and global economy. And indeed, the Islamists and al-Qaeda, to be seen in the context of the For the Record inquiry as basically foot soldiers, combatants for the underground Reich, they have said in so many words that they believe the key to destroying America is destroying its economy. Well, I've said in the past that the Bush administration has been doing a pretty good job of that. The engineer has, in fact, wrecked the train. And it'll be interesting to see if the Islamists come along and shoot the passengers on the derailed train, that being all of us, or at least destroying us, if not actually physically killing us. And we need to take a very, very good look at what might happen to a Barack Obama presidency, because indeed I think some of the forces that were swift-boating Barack Obama, attempting to tar him with the Islamist-slash-terror brush, might very well use those very same tactics in the event that there's a real incident during the course of a Barack Obama presidency. We're going to begin by taking a look at a column that was run on the San Francisco Chronicle from Friday, August 15th of 2008. And again, we're going to be taking a look at tactics that were used against Obama during the campaign. And we're going to look ahead and see the and discuss the extent to which these could be used to tar him and discredit him, perhaps even lead to his impeachment or assassination at the hands of disgruntled elements of the national security establishment, if he can successfully be swift-boated, so to speak, after his election. This is a column by Eugene Robinson, and even though we're talking about the campaign here, again, I stress that I think it's important to assess these tactics and how they might be used against an Obama presidency. This Eugene Robinson column was entitled by the San Francisco Chronicle of 8-15-08, "Don't Let Swift Boaters Sail Again," and it reads in part as follows. Here come the goons, right on schedule. The author, and I use the term loosely, whose vicious lies damaged John Kerry's 2004 presidential campaign, has crawled back out from under his rock to spew vicious lies about Barack Obama. Right-wing radio talk show hosts are dutifully transmitting this concocted venom. This presidential campaign has officially gotten ugly. Skipping down, the author in question is named Jerome Corsi, and Eugene Robinson talks about that, and then goes on to say about Corsi, Corsi would be known as just another visitor from the outer fringe if he had not been the author of Unfit for Command, the book that slammed Kerry's exemplary record as a swift boat commander in Vietnam. The allegations in that book were discredited, but not before they had been amplified by the right-wing echo chamber to the point where they raised questions in some voters' minds, perhaps enough to swing the election. It was an abominable trick, but quite remarkable. Kerry's opponent, George W. Bush, had avoided Vietnam by taking refuge in the Texas Air National Guard. Kerry was a decorated war hero, yet, somehow, his valor and sense of duty were turned into a political negative and used against him. Now, Corsi, in what he acknowledges is an attempt to keep Obama from getting elected, unquote, has come out with a book that similarly tries to turn one of Obama's strengths, his compelling life story, into a liability. Corsi's new volume of vitriol, The Obama Nation, seeks to smear Obama as a leftist and add fuel to the false and discredited rumor that he is secretly a radical Muslim, or at least has, quote, extensive connections to Islam, unquote. The liberal website Media Matters has already demonstrated that the book is riddled with factual errors. For example, Corsi repeats the charge, thoroughly disproved, that Obama was in church for one of the Reverend Jeremiah Wright's most incendiary sermons. But the point isn't to tell the truth. The point is to repeat the lie and thus give it new life. Corsi's dirty work is more difficult this time because Obama has already written his life story in the autobiographical Dreams from My Father, unquote. Because he can't reveal anything about Obama's past, Corsi is reduced to reinterpretation or, at times, invention. It sounds like the kind of book that should quickly be consigned to the remainder bin, but, unsurprisingly, it's already a bestseller. The Washington Post and other news organizations have noted that this and similar anti-Obama books win the imprimatur of bestseller status by being, quote, pushed by conservative book clubs that buy in bulk to drive up sales, unquote. This time, though, somebody is pushing back. John Kerry, whose political action committee has launched a new website called Truth Fights Back to Fight Against the Right-Wing Smear Machine, unquote. The site weighs in vigorously on behalf of several Democrats who are being hit with unfair attacks, but its most urgent campaign is, quote, making sure Jerome Corsi doesn't get away with his lies unchallenged, unquote. The Obama campaign faces a classic dilemma. If smear attacks are left unanswered, voters can get the impression that the lies are true. But there's no way to respond without giving the falsehoods wider circulation. For Obama, this choice seems doubly fraught. Just look at the way Senator John McCain's campaign jumped all over Obama when he predicted correctly, it turns out, that Republicans would try to scare voters by making him seem alien and somehow frightening. His observation about not looking like previous presidents was opportunistically slammed by McCain and his surrogates as, quote, playing the race card, unquote. So far, the Obama campaign's reaction to the Corsi book has been fairly muted, in part because others such as Kerry have stepped up to give a more full-throated response. Kerry knows better than anyone what it feels like to be swift-boated, and he's determined not to let it happen to anyone else. Well, Obviously, this sort of thing did not prevail during the campaign. Had the economy not collapsed in mid-September, it might have been very interesting to see just what transpired in this campaign, because it was getting pretty ugly. And I do not dismiss the possibility that the bad jacketing tactics pursued by the Republicans might have succeeded. I'm going to introduce a term, a self-invented term. Maybe somebody else has come up with it. I don't know. But I'm going to introduce the concept of deep bad jacketing. I wonder to what extent Barack Obama had been targeted by his enemies very, very early on. And that sort of deep badjacketing, sort of helping to structure the actual Democratic primary campaign in such a way as to place an individual the Republicans seemed vulnerable into the position of being the Democratic nominee, I wonder to what extent that took place. In future programs, I'm going to explore Barack Obama's background. I think there's a very good chance that he's actually an intelligence operative of some kind, quite possibly belonging to a reformist faction of the CIA or some other intelligence service. I do not hold that against him. Indeed, I think that Obama has been tabbed by some as a reformer. He's a very bright guy and can do as he doesn't need somebody to write his own speeches. I was less than crazy about his supporters during the campaign, but the fact of the matter is he is, if his administration doesn't succeed, we're all screwed. We are all thoroughly, thoroughly effed. And so I think anybody who's serious about this country and about life itself has to wish his presidency all the best and do what they can to support him. And indeed, this program is being recorded in that same spirit and vein. I do think that there's a very good chance Obama is an intelligence operative of some kind, quite possibly some faction of CIA. He may have been infiltrated into the unsavory milieu in Chicago into which he was introduced to spy on them, basically. I don't know. What I do know, though, is that some of his Chicago-area associations could be used to badjacket Obama in the future, particularly in the wake of a devastating terror incident, and whereas during the presidential campaign, the Islamic terror front was quiet. No sooner do we have Obama becoming elected and moving toward the White House with a devastated economy than there's an Islamist threat against New York, the American financial center, and a very real actualized attack on Mumbai, the financial center in India. That attack also has already made Barack Obama's presidency very much more complicated because the foreign policy dictates that he's going to have to pursue are going to be that much more complex in that very already complex and sensitive area. Indeed, one of the things that Ayman al-Zawahiri said in his racist attack on Obama is that Obama was going to try to raise the troop level in Afghanistan to defeat the Taliban and that would not work. The recent attack in Mumbai, in addition to sending a message to the world's industrial and financial centers that they're vulnerable, certainly is going to make what Barack Obama hopes to do on the Indian on the Pakistani-Afghani front that much more complex. I wonder to what extent Barack Obama has been the target of deep bad jacketing. And I first got the hint of this when I read an op-ed column in the Financial Times in December of 2007. It's a very unusual op-ed column because it's an op-ed column written by none other than Karl Rove, good old 666 himself. Karl Rove is the real master demon bloodletter slash fascist. So you just any bad word you can think of behind George W. Bush. He's the real Machiavellian string puller of this White House. And in December, specifically on December 2nd of 2007, he penned the following column for the Financial Times. Basically, he was giving advice to Barack Obama on how to beat Hillary Clinton. The column was titled, Memo to Obama, Win Iowa or Lose the Race. It's by Karl Rove, old 666 himself, and it reads in part as follows. Not that you have asked for advice, but here it is anyway. Iowa is your best chance to beat her. If you do not do it there, odds are you never will anywhere. You are way behind her in most national polls. The only way to change that is to beat her in Iowa so people around America take another look at you. You did a smart thing organizing effectively in the early primary states, but you can take advantage of that only if you win Iowa and keep her from building an overwhelming sense of invincibility and inevitability. The good news is you have again got the buzz, unquote. Polls are looking better for you in Iowa and the other early states. Your press is improving, with your performance at the Iowa Jefferson Jackson dinner a big help. Hillary Clinton has made unforced errors, but she's still the front runner, and there are several things you need to do quickly to win. First, stop acting like a vitamin-deficient Adlai Stevenson. Strike a pose of being high-minded and too pure will not work. Americans want to see you scrapping and fighting for the job, not in a mean or ugly way, but in a forceful and straightforward way. Hillary may come over as calculating and shifty, but she looks in control. You, on the other hand, often come over as weak and ineffectual. In some debates, you don't even look at her when you disagree with her, making it look as if you're afraid of her. She offers you openings time and again, but you don't take advantage of them. Sharpen your attacks and make them more precise. Take the exchange in the Philadelphia debate about Bill and Hillary keeping documents hidden about her role as First Lady in the White House. She was evasive. You spoke next. You would have won a big victory if you turned to her and said, "Senator, with all due respect, you and your husband could release those documents right now if you wanted to." Your failure to do so raises questions among a lot of Americans about what you're hiding, and those questions would hurt our party if you were our nominee, unquote. But your response was weak as dirty dishwater. Don't let other great opportunities pass by. Second, focus on the fact that many Democrats have real doubts about Hillary. They worry she can't win, will be a drag on the ticket, and that if she got to the White House, it would be a disaster. You know better than most what they're worried about. They have told you their fears. It's why you've done so well raising money from Bill's backers and gaining support from Clinton administration officials. Talk about those doubts. Put them in a bigger context than the two of you. Remind primary voters that these shortcomings will hurt Democratic chances. And the column goes on in that vein. It's actually fairly savvy political advice in and of itself. But what is so interesting about this is that here you have the beast himself, old 666 Karl Rove, connected to the Islamic Institute. In fact, one of the generators of the Islamic Institute, which we're going to talk about later. That's the point of interface between the Republican Party and the very Islamic slash Muslim Brotherhood terrorists they profess to be opposed to. And Karl Rove is one of the people who put that together. What you have here, though, in December of 2007, is Karl Rove advising Barack Obama on how to beat Hillary Clinton. This is something about which I have more questions and answers. I think it's clear from this, though, that Karl Rove was quite happy to see Barack Obama get the nominee. Now, he may have figured that there was no way a black man was going to get elected president of the United States. Had the economy not tanked in mid-September, this would have been a very interesting race indeed, an even uglier one than it was. McCain came out of the Republican convention with a 3-point lead due to the bounce. It remains to be seen what would have happened during the campaign. But in the event, obviously, Barack Obama got elected. What I wonder is this. To what extent was Karl Rove taking a look at Barack Obama early on and hoping, basically, that he would get the nominee, because in the Rove worldview, that would have made the Democrats more vulnerable. We're going to review ever so well. Actually, you know, what I'm going to do is simply allude to information in a couple of articles that I read in For the Record 654. Now, when I went into some of Barack Obama's Chicago slumlord connections, I noted that an individual who was far more closely connected to Barack Obama than Obama has ever admitted, namely Antoine Tony Rezko, a native of Syria, in fact was something of a political godfather to Obama. He wasn't just a casual acquaintance. They were very, very close. And indeed, Barack Obama was part of a really sleazy slumlord network in the Chicago area that were basically devoting much of their effort towards screwing poor black people, which is not particularly inspiring. As I said, I don't necessarily hold that against Barack Obama simply because there is no way in hell anybody's going to become a major party presidential candidate, let alone president of the United States, without making deals with some pretty nasty interests. That's just the way it goes. So, again, I don't hold that against him. What I think is significant is that the Tony Rezko slash slumlord Chicago Daily Machine milieu, in turn, is very closely connected to the Bush White House, the Republican Party, people and elements connected to Karl Rove, people and elements connected to the Carlyle Group. In other words, the elements that we find in Obama's presence in Chicago, in his milieu, my word again, in Chicago, are elements that are connected to the people who would have the greatest stake in destroying Barack Obama. They would have had the greatest stake in destroying an Obama candidacy, had the economy not collapsed, and they will have the greatest stake in destroying not only an Obama presidency, but the United States itself, and that is the GOP slash Islamist slash underground Reich pincers movement slash fifth column, about which I have spoken so often. For the record, 654 and the descriptions for that, and specifically I'll give you the two articles that have the information. They're both by Evelyn Pringle, both available on the Scoop New Zealand website, both on the website of Joseph Cannon, a blogger whose Cannon Fire website bears scrutiny. One of the articles from March 29th of 2008 was called Barack Obama, the Wizard of Oz, and that again by Evelyn Pringle. The other Evelyn Pringle article from Monday, April 21st of 2008, Barack Obama, Subplots of Operation Board Games. And in those articles, the links between the Obama slumlord milieu, the Daily Machine, and the Republican Party, specifically people, elements, and people like Karl Rove, the Carlyle Group, the GOP, the Bush administration, are set forth in some detail. Now, by way of looking at deep bad jacketing, I'm going to review a little bit about just how Karl Rove works. And a lot of people have Karl Rove is a very distinctive individual, and bad jacketing is his stock in trade. And for the record, 319, a section of the description for which I'm going to reprise right now, we took a look at how Karl Rove set up the late J.H. Hatfield, the author of Fortunate Son, an individual with a criminal record, to take the fall and deliberately leak the story of George W. Bush's cocaine use to J.H. Hatfield, who broke the story. It became a sensation. Then when Hatfield's criminal record came out, that destroyed J.H. Hatfield, who died under strained circumstances. Some say he killed himself. Some say he was murdered. A sad situation, regardless of what the case was. But taking a look at how Karl Rove works in order to understand what might be directed against a Barack Obama presidency is, I think, mandatory. From the description for the Record 319, Bush League, Part 3, recorded on August 4th, 2001, we read, much of the broadcast deals with the Machiavellian Karl Rove, the Bush aide credited with much of W's political success. In For the Record 315, we examine the untimely and suspicious death of J.H. Hatfield, the author of Fortunate Son, a Bush biography that highlighted W's drug abuse and, more importantly, the business connections between Bush and the bin Laden family. The aforementioned For the Record 248 is among the programs that highlights the Hatfield material on the Bush-Bin Laden family Arbusto energy connection. Karl Rove was alleged to be the publisher of the Karl Rove was alleged by the publisher of the paperback edition of Fortunate Son to be a source who funneled disinformation to Hatfield to discredit him. The Eufaula connection? That was Karl Rove. This is in quotes, by the way, beginning again. The Eufaula connection? That was Karl Rove. That was Carl T. Rove. The other top Bush advisor was Clay Johnson. The Bush confidant source was his minister, Mayfield. Now you know. Remember, you've got to swear now. J.H. Hatfield had just identified Carl T. Rove, the Bush campaign's senior advisor to me personally, as the primary source for the G.W. Bush cocaine arrest story. It took me that whole year to understand why Rove would do such a thing, unquote. And this is an article, by the way, called George W. Bush's Brain, How Carl T. Rove Used Fortunate Son to Stick George W. Bush in the White House by Sander Hicks, the author of The Big Wedding, a book about which I've interviewed Sander on this program. This was from Online Journal's issue of May 23rd, 2001. In the description for 319, if we continue, Hicks discusses the background of the stifled press about W's drug abuse. Quote, when the media stumbled upon the story that George W. Bush was arrested for a cocaine possession in 1972, it was through an anonymous tip reported by a columnist at Salon.com. Bush up to his allegations, sharp-toothed email, killer bees, and bags of worms. Willis Hound Hunt, unquote, by Amy Reiter. Hatfield's book was in the final proofing stages when this hot story broke on August 25, 1999. The piece was the first to state that Bush had been arrested in the early 1970s and he was ordered by a Texas judge to perform community service in exchange for expunging his record showing illicit drug use, according to the source. To make matters worse, that August, Bush went out on his own on the campaign trail and improvised on camera about his drug past. With his handlers out of town ghostwriting his autobiography, unquote, he blurted out at a press conference that he hadn't done drugs since 1974. The media crowed at the spectacle. For instance, USA Today gushed, quote, Bush has admitted something, but he refuses to say what, unquote. Enter J.H. Hatfield and Karl Rove. Quote, Hatfield, who long suspected something was awry in young Bush's Playboy days, went back to his Texas sources to corroborate this story through Clay Johnson and Karl Rove, his regular sources of information. According to Hatfield, Rove and Johnson explained the cocaine arrest on the phone under conditions of anonymity. Rove had earlier taken Hatfield on a fishing trip to Lake Eufaula, okay, to discuss Bush, so his pseudonym in the afterword became the cloak and dagger-esque The Eufaula Connection, unquote. Then Hicks discusses Rove's reasons for selecting Hatfield. Quote, why choose Jim Hatfield? Hatfield had committed his 1987 crime in Dallas, where longtime Bush schoolmate and friend Clay Johnson was an associate. Johnson was friends with Hatfield's employer Larry Burke and Kay Burrow. He would have heard about the violent workplace conspiracy that stemmed from an illicit affair Burke was having with Burrow. Burrow had tried to blackmail Burke, and Hatfield took the fall for the attempt he arranged on Burrow's life at his boss Burke's request, unquote. Hicks next highlights the alleged feeding of disinformation to Hatfield in order to further the discreditation project. Quote, Rove and Johnson further ensured that they could discredit Hatfield by feeding him flawed information. This, by the way, is badjacketing. This is what we're looking at here, is Karl Rove badjacketing the Bush cocaine bust. Continuing. They altered key facts in the cocaine arrest story and thus raised the burden of proof for future reporters. At one point, Hatfield was told that the arresting judge was a Republican, a falsehood which, although easily detected, served to damage Hatfield's credibility. After St. Martin's rushed the cocaine arrest story into the book as an afterword, suddenly the Dallas Morning News received the private criminal record of J.H. Hatfield's felony in Texas. The news published an article about Hatfield's felonious past, and it was all over for the Bush cocaine arrest story, unquote. All in a day's work might very well sum up Hicks' assessment of Rove's machinations. What is to be pondered in this context is the fact of Hatfield's untimely death. Like the late Senator Paul Wellstone, Hatfield had been targeted by Rove. As to whether Rove had anything to do with their deaths is anybody's guess. This style of disinformation follows the pattern set by all masters of public opinion of the 20th century. Carl T. Rove is an avid history buff and applies what he reads. In just 2 short months, he surgically removed the media's talk of the Bush drug arrest by feeding it to a biographer he knew had a felony conviction in his past. Hatfield broke the story, and then Rove broke Hatfield. The Bush campaign's friends at the Dallas Morning News broke a salacious, mesmerizing story about a car bomb, a hitman, a boss, a felony connection, and the mass media's attention is focused en masse on Hatfield, who can't take the heat, denies the allegations, and flees town. St. Martin's doesn't know what's going on, but suddenly they're getting threatened by Bush campaign lawyers who are looking into, unquote, suing them. St. Martin's behavior becomes paranoid. They announce they're pulling 88,000 copies of the book from stores. So much for America. So much for the Bill of Rights. This, folks, is Karl Rove in action. And I think we need to ask the question to what extent the Rove brain has been busily at work on Barack Obama, and to what extent we're likely to see Karl Rove, who along with Grover Norquist and Talat Ataman launched the Islamic Institute, the point of interface between the GOP and the very Islamist terrorists we are told they oppose. In fact, they are in bed together, and we're going to take a look at that pincers movement in Fifth Column at work badjacketing Barack Obama inside two of the program. I've made many references to many things. Please use the new website, spitfirelist.com. New site, same fight. They've got a lot of files still to transfer. There's still some bugs to be worked out. We're aware of this. If you find something, communicate it to the webmaster, but please use that website. It's a remarkable research resource. It's got tons of printed information, an entire mini library of old anti-fascist books, links. It's got plenty of audio links. It's got links to the WFMU website. It's even got a page you can click on to support the work I'm doing. And if you don't like what you see, there's no better way to fight back than to support the work I'm doing. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 655, The Obama File Part 2, Badjacketing Obama. This is being recorded on November 29th of 2008. And my name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.